Welcome to the Andrew Holland Podcast, where we explore the stories of successful people, get insight and advice from individuals who have accomplished amazing things, and dive deep into understanding ourselves as human beings. Now, here's your host, Andrew Holland.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Andrew Holland Podcast. Joining me in studio today is Sherman Cawley of Cawley Architects, one of the top, if not the top, design build firms here in Phoenix, Arizona. They've been around, actually, they just celebrated their 30th anniversary on April 4th this year, and they've done over 900 high-value commercial projects or residential projects. You guys do both.
No, just mostly commercial.
Just commercial.
Right.
And over 20 million square feet. Sherm?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and welcome to the Andrew Holland Podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
So your story is one that expands 45 years. You've been doing architecture in the Valley.
That's right.
You got started during a very interesting time in the early 1990s, during the savings and loans crisis.
Right.
But before we do that, get there. Take us back. You're a native Arizonan,
right?
Born and raised in Tucson, went to Cornell University. So you left for a little while, became an architect or went to architecting school and then came back. Give us some insight on your history and how you ultimately decided, you know what, I'm an entrepreneur and I'm going to open my own shop.
Okay. Well, I'd love to. Thank you. So yes. And I went to Rincon High School when I was growing up in Tucson. So that also, interestingly enough, is something that I've been able to stay involved in. As an alumnus. So I've enjoyed that. Anyway, I loved growing up in Tucson. It was great. My family was from New England. And so I always felt like I had one foot in New England as I was growing up. So when I was accepted to Cornell, to the architecture school there, I felt very comfortable about going back east.
Are you a Patriots fan or football fan at all?
No.
Okay.
I wasn't a sports fan back then.
Okay.
I certainly am now, of course. But
yeah, when your team wins all the time, of course, of course you become a fan, right? Although they've had their moments now that Tom Brady and the coach Belichick is gone.
Well, what I loved when I was there, because after I graduated from Cornell, I went to Boston and lived there for 7 years. And of course, there I love the Red Sox. So that was really fun. But my story is that I always, always wanted to be an architect. When I was going to school in Tucson and went into middle school at that particular period of time, it was just seventh and eighth grade, I was in a drafting class and won first place in the Arizona State Fair for my drafting. And I thought, wow, I can do this.
This was in seventh or eighth grade?
This is eighth grade.
Eighth grade.
Yeah, I can do this. And I had always been interested in form, not necessarily sculpture, but certainly form. And the other thing that I recognized about myself early on in life was that I loved projects. So in most cases, those were just book report projects, you know, where I had to write the book report about the various kinds of boats that were, you know, in the world in the 1600s. But I actually built the models and everything, and I loved that. So between a love of form and a love of projects and a love of drafting and whatnot, I thought, well, this is something I really want to do. And I've never, ever changed.
That's a huge blessing because a lot of people have to take many years.
That's right.
Including myself to figure out what do they want to do. So where did that come from? Were your parents engineers or?
No, not at all. You know, it probably came a little bit from my mom, but I really don't have a firm explanation. I just know that it's true, and it's always been true. And I've been very blessed. I mean, I really have had a wonderful career, and it's been so fulfilling that I feel vindicated by my original selection.
Yeah, I think you did something right. I would say, I would definitely say. So you go to Cornell.
Well, let me say that I did go to Cornell and had a I succeeded very well in high school and got great grades and whatnot. And that's why I was, of course, accepted. But when I went to Cornell, I was completely out of my league. I suffered terribly there, to the point where I loved Cornell. I loved my friends. I loved my classmates. But I was not a good architect in school. I wasn't a prolific designer. And I struggled terribly to the point where when I got out of school, I really felt like I had no capabilities whatsoever. So this is an interesting part of my history.
Yeah.
Is then that I went to Boston because I was comfortable going there and I was really looking forward to it. And for 7 years, I did everything under the sun except architecture. So I struggled. I was depressed at that time of my life, just emotionally.
Because you always wanted to be an architect, you went to Cornell and you maybe...
I lost my way.
Questioned.
I did. I questioned my ability and what it meant. And I was suffering from other emotional issues at the time too, because in your 20s, that's when you're growing emotionally anyway.
They can be very challenging.
Yes. So as a consequence, I got involved with a therapeutic community and a therapist. And long story short, I was able to really, I was able to heal myself. And I was able to understand the root of, you know, my own personal dilemmas, which I am very, very thankful for and always grateful for the associations and for the connections I was able to make in Boston during that time. I actually worked with an extremely innovative therapist who was wonderful and to this day represents a sort of a psychological father for me that I've always really... really appreciated. And I haven't needed that for the last 20 years, but on the other hand, it certainly provided the foundation for me emerging and coming back to then Phoenix and getting started in what I always wanted to do, which is be an architect and work in architecture.
Have a million questions about that period in your life, and we'll get to it. And the whole concept of therapy and why I think that is so important.
Right. Yeah.
I do think the stigma, there used to be a stigma. I think that's fading away, but we'll get there.
Okay.
So when you're in Boston, you say you're doing anything and everything under the sun.
Yeah, I drove cab.
I drove cab.
I love to show my pictures of my cab licenses because it shows me in very long hair with a mustache and looking like a total derelict, looking like a fantastic derelict. And as a matter of fact, I still show these today and everyone goes like, that is so cool. That is amazing.
Is this what, the 70s?
Yeah, it was absolutely in the 70s from 72 to 79. Okay. 78, okay. 72 to 78.
So you're driving cab. You stumbled into that?
No, I had to. I had to find a way.
Okay. Yeah. And that's what you did in Boston pretty much the whole time.
No, I did other things too. So I opened my own little wood shop and I built cabinets for a while. I taught crafts and woodworking and other kinds of... skills in drug programs. So those were three jobs I had. I may have had a fourth. Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, in the therapeutic community I was a member of during that time in Boston, I also worked there as a staff member for a while. I kind of did maintenance and those kinds of things. So as you can see, those are my salad days. And none of them I had any money involved. Mm-hmm. You know, these were all just subsistence living. But it was enough for me to, you know, concentrate on myself and do what I wanted to do. And like I said before, I had great associations, which I thoroughly enjoyed and love to this day.
And you've maintained.
Thank you. Absolutely.
So you found yourself, figured yourself out in your 20s.
Yes.
And that ultimately led you back to Phoenix, Arizona.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that and then coming here and starting your own firm.
At the very end of my experience in Boston, for the last year, I really did begin to interview in architectural offices. And there was a slight downturn in the market there. That would have been 78. Mm-hmm. So because I had been out for so long and was basically just a newbie, I just didn't get any offers. And I realized that if I did come home, that I would be a little bigger fish in a little smaller, you know, in a little smaller pond. And that felt right to me. I came home for Christmas in 78 and looked at the job market in Phoenix and during that time and flew back and then picked up my car, threw everything in my car, came to Phoenix and got a job within 2 days.
At an architect firm.
Yeah, correct.
Wow. So Phoenix was a lot smaller than Boston at that time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
This would have been 79. So this is January of 79.
Okay. Yeah. Come back.
Right.
And
so then I got an apartment and started working, which was such a pleasure. It was so cool. I just really loved it.
How did you get your mojo back for architect work?
I never lost it. I never lost the thrill of being able to design and all of that. It's just that I just felt like I couldn't do it. And it was scary to me during that time when I was sort of kind of recovering emotionally. It was scary for me to put myself in that position where I was just unsure of myself. Mm-hmm.
So it was more here than anything.
Oh,
you
absolutely
had the skills and the capabilities.
Yes.
It was just you had to get this in the right spot.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I hadn't heard it explained that way, yeah, but that's exactly right.
For those of you listening, I'm pointing to my head.
Exactly right.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So you come back early, well, 78, 79.
79. I was here in January 79, got a job in 2 days and worked in that firm for 13 years.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of that firm?
Design Lab.
Okay. Still around today?
No, it's not.
Okay.
But several of the members of the firm are still here in the Valley, and we like to reminisce from time to time.
You work with them for about 11, 12 years.
13 years.
13 years. Exactly. Okay.
Yep.
And then the 1990s come along.
Right.
How did you decide, you know what, I've learned what I want to learn and I want to start my own firm?
Another recession. Can you believe it? Our industry is so cyclical,
yeah,
and it's completely dependent upon, you know, the state of the economy. And thank God for Phoenix's, you know, emergence into a fully capable economy here that's competitive with all the other great economies of the West. When I started, that was not the case. Mm-hmm. Phoenix was completely dependent upon construction. And so as a consequence, when I was in the very early 90s, 1990, that was the start of the savings and loan crisis, mm-hmm, with that very famous developer who was a former governor of the state. What was that gentleman's name? You may remember. I don't remember right now.
I don't either.
Something like Cunningham or something. Anyway, he was involved in a lot of savings and loans kind of, what do you say? I guess at that point, they actually busted him on fraud. But on the other hand, there were probably 11 to 13 savings and loans associations in the state in the late 80s. But they all had bad loans, mm-hmm, and all started to go belly up. And by the time they were done in the early 90s, 91, 92, 93, there was only one savings and loan left. All the others all were absorbed through other banking institutions, just, you know, through the federal government's efforts.
And this was, so of course, happening across the country in the early,
yes,
90s, not just in Phoenix, but Phoenix,
but
was particularly
because
hit.
Because we were so construction,
yeah,
you know, focused and dependent. It really hit us hard. So, the firm that I was in really couldn't support me anymore. Mm-hmm. So as a consequence, they said, well, I'm sorry, this is the end for us. I said, well, that's fine. So here's an interesting thing. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
You ask me, like, you know, what was my attitude when I went out on my own? And I have thought about that and thought about that and thought about that. And I can tell you authoritatively, I didn't feel any anxiety about that.
Why?
Isn't that, I don't know why. I've thought about it and thought about it, and I just thought, I can do this. I can do this.
Do you think it's because you found yourself?
Yes.
During the 70s through a therapeutic,
yeah,
experience?
Yeah, and because I had great experiences during those 13 years working. Mm-hmm. I had created many associations. I had work I could rely on. I was confident that I could do it.
You built your confidence.
Yes. But here's such an interesting little, anecdote. Here's a really interesting anecdote that I love to talk about and tell people about. My very, very good friend who I went to Cornell with said, who also started his own firm, he said, Sherm, he said, you should absolutely do this, but I can tell you that the experience is a little bit like passing through a mirror. As you approach the mirror, the only thing you can see is yourself, and you have no idea what's on the other side. Isn't that a wonderful analogy?
Yeah, it really is.
And it's spectacular.
I've never thought about it that way. But
yeah,
when I think about approaching a mirror,
yeah, that's all you see is yourself.
It's really all you focus on, too.
Right. But you have
what
to
did
realize,
he mean by that, though?
Well, he meant that you don't really know what's going to happen.
Okay.
You cannot predict what's going to happen. You're out there on your own. You have to rely upon everything you've built to date, and you have to rely on your own skills and expertise. But the other thing was that the industry was in a recession, so there wasn't a lot of work out there. So I just went home for 2 years. I was a sole practitioner. I worked out of a small home office, and I appealed to clients who were very interested in working with me because I was smaller and had lower fees and could work efficiently. Mm-hmm. And that's what sustained me. And I also then formed relationships with contractors, small contractors around the valley, and that sustained me for a few years.
And so these were relationships that you had made when you were working at Design Lab.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask, oh, there's a recession. Great. Let's start a business.
Yeah.
that's usually not a logical progression, but no. The way you just described it, start small. But there's still deals out there to be had.
Absolutely.
And slowly
as
build.
A matter of fact, you need to be small and lithe and flexible and extremely efficient. Now, quite frankly, we saw a great deal of that 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. 2010. I mean, our industry, pardon me, lost a tremendous number of practitioners, many of whom decided to go out on their own or do drafting services or do remodels or, quite frankly, go into other industries. Mm-hmm. But there was a tremendous attrition, after that worldwide recession of 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, all that time, which we can talk about, by the way.
Well, yeah, I want to, because what I heard you say earlier is you're thankful that Phoenix isn't so construction dependent as it was in the early 90s.
Right.
But I question that.
Okay.
Or I want to push you on that a little bit. Because look at what happened in 2008. Who are the
That's what started it.
Areas in the United States, Florida and Arizona. So we were still at that point very construction dependent.
And at that point, we absolutely were. And that's why it hit us so hard. And it was a complete realization to everybody in the valley, all the captains of industry, everybody who was an economic driver of any kind, all totally understood our circumstances, which is that we were a construction dependent. So that's really what started, the great effort that Chris Camacho and everybody else has so worked so hard on, the economic development directors for all the municipalities, the state. Everybody started working on diversifying mm-hmm. our economic base. And quite frankly, we have the city of Phoenix and ASU to thank for providing the seeds and the germs of our growing economic base now with everything they did downtown with biotech mm-hmm. and then bringing in ASU and putting a campus downtown. Between those two enormously important and impactful contributions towards the growth of Phoenix. I mean, you have to remember too that in 2007, 8, and 9, there was no life downtown. Mm-hmm. And that was the other great complaint that everybody had. We basically had, no viable downtown. So as a consequence, everyone started working on that. And I think that from my understanding as a very interested bystander, those were the two probably most important contributors towards the eventual resurgence of a much broader kind of economy here based on many, many other industries for the valley. Well, in any case, in my own case, I was just working at home on a couple of buildings and a couple of TIs, small restaurants and things like that.
Yeah. But before we jump back into your story.
Yeah.
So do you think, in our intro call, you said that Phoenix has always been a boom or bust area. Very construction.
Less so now.
Okay. So that's my question. Yeah. Do you think that has materially changed since 2008, since 1990 and the previous?
Oh, absolutely.
So you don't believe, and I want to talk about this a little later in the episode, what we're seeing in real estate, commercial real estate, interest rates, and questions that I have for someone who is so experienced, not only in the valley, but in the construction industry, which no matter where you are, is a pillar of economic activity.
Yeah.
When you look at any GDP or any type of multiplier effect, construction is where it starts because it employs so many different talents, industries, all the blue collar, all the material shops, retail, goes on and on and on.
Okay.
We'll talk about that in just a bit and where you see this market and the impact of things I think are coming. Back to 1990s.
Yes.
What made you decide to leave your home and open up call the architects?
Okay, so I had formed a relationship with a very prominent design build contractor here in the late 80s at my firm. So that was just serendipitous. We actually ran into someone that's so well known here in the Valley, and that was Dave Sellers from at that point, JKD.
Senior, Dave Sellers, Dave senior.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, of course, you had Carrie on here, you know, quite a few episodes ago.
Yep.
And she was the one who referred me to you, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the opportunity. But we have a common history there of having done so much work, you know, through that whole episode. So I had met Dave Sellers Sr. and we formed a relationship in the late 80s. And when the savings and loan recession hit, he just retired. He went somewhere else. He went to Colorado and got out of the construction business and waited and did other things. Well, he came back in 1994 because the economy had recovered enough so that there was actually construction going on. And he rebranded his firm. And then he reached out to me and he said, "Hey, I need an architect. I'd love to start something with you." And that was a thrill for me. So that's what brought me out of my own home.
That was unexpected at the time.
It was, I would, yes, absolutely. He had reached out to me just before he came and said, "Hey, I'd love to talk to you. I'm starting again. You know, I'd love to, you know, put something together if we can." And I said, "Yeah, absolutely. I'm all ears." So, so we did. In 1994, he started a small office. I got out of my home and started a small office, rented space and whatnot, and got an employee. And that was a start of a wonderful, wonderful 20-year run. So another thing that we have focused on that's so important to us is a design build. Design build is an approach towards the built environment.
Explain to our listeners what that means.
Absolutely. So design build is a cooperative partnership under many, many forms between a design effort and a construction effort. So in this particular case, it'd be a design office and a construction office.
So your architectural firm.
Yes.
With
a construction firm.
A construction firm, a GC.
Right.
And is there a development company in the mix there somewhere?
Absolutely, as a client.
Okay.
So it could be a client of any kind. So it could be a user, like a single company that needs a new facility. It can be a developer who is very interested in developing a project, either for lease or for what we used to call build-a-suit back then. So the contractor and the design firm form a coalition together under a number of formats to enhance the process for the client, for the customer, for the small business that needs a facility. And the reason that this is a huge enhancement is then that it's very, very important as the project is developed as a design concept that it also be priced so that the client or the company that these services are for always knows how much this whole effort is going to cost.
That's kind of important, right?
Yeah, no, actually, and it's we pride ourselves in overcoming many of the kind of inherent fallibilities of a traditional services architectural office, and most importantly through the design build process, because this is a huge area in the industry, less so these days because of the importance of the design build approach. Hardly anyone will go to an architect these days other than for a smaller project and say, "Here, design me a project. And let's see how it turns out." Because ultimately, when the project goes out to bid, then it always comes in over budget because it was never priced in the first place during the development of the process.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, then there's a setback in terms of the schedule of the project. But then there's also more costs involved in having to revise whatever needs to be revised. And all of that is all possible during the initial phases.
So to break it down into its simplest parts.
Yeah.
And tell me if I'm reiterating this incorrectly. Essentially, you get someone like Colley Architects involved at the beginning of committing to a project to understand the design elements and the cost.
Correct.
And once you've gone through that due diligence, what I'm causing due diligence phase, then you have a better determination as to whether this is a feasible project or whether it's non-feasible, correct?
That's correct. And then the other thing you do is you get a chance to assess your team.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, this isn't our contractor. It's any contractor. Mm-hmm. So we have a stable of contractors, obviously, like any successful business that mm-hmm. we always work with. It's very, very important to develop those relationships, as you know, and that's inherent in any business. But on the other hand, we can make a recommendation for a contractor, or they can bring their own contractor, or they can poll the industry and use us as a resource, but talk with others to bring a contractor to the initial sessions. But mm-hmm. the most important thing is the partnership.
Yeah. What is the opposite of a design build firm?
Just a traditional services firm that will go ahead and design a project without necessarily having the contributions of pricing all the way along. Now you can, under certain circumstances, use a construction manager rather than a construction outfit. Somebody may feel reluctant in terms of hiring a contractor right away. Mm-hmm. So you can do design bid build, where a contractor is used for pricing during the initial design phases, but they don't necessarily have the contract for the project. They only have an opportunity to gain the project through a bid process at the end. The concept there under design bid build is simply that's the contractor who has the most experience on the project. Yeah. He's been working on it from day one. He's going to have the best pricing because he's going to know exactly all the ins and outs, all the pitfalls, all the things to avoid, all the things where he can gain a little advantage over his competition. So that's a very valuable process.
Yeah.
But you can also do a CM generated project as well, a construction manager generated project. And we've done several of those recently where, you're working with a construction manager who prices it as you go along so that the client still knows the generalities of what the overall cost is going to be.
So you actually start the project without knowing the final cost, but the construction manager keeps the client or the development company, depending who it is,
right,
up to date on what those costs are.
Exactly.
Why would anybody do that without knowing the costs in advance?
You mean a project?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't happen these days, especially for anything larger, of course.
Okay.
So it used to be even 10, 15, 20 years ago that about 40 or 45% of the industry all did some version of design build. I haven't seen a figure recently, but it's probably 60 or 70% of the industry.
Because people realize the inherent risk and the alternative option.
So here's two things about our business. First of all, we've had the wonderful opportunity of being able to work with small businessmen who are just exactly like us. They're just out there doing what they love to do, and they're out there doing what we do every day, which is just turning the crank. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so these are all wonderful, wonderful people, either entrepreneurs or family businesses or whatnot. So that's number one. And number two is, this is probably the most expensive thing they're ever going to do.
Yeah.
A facility for their company is probably the most expensive. If you're getting into high manufacturing, then obviously equipment and all that's going to be up to that much or more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we can confidently say that it's one of the most expensive things they will ever do. So that's why we loved working with contractors, because we knew we were delivering a coherent, viable service that had credibility. We knew we had credibility because we were working with contractors who were also, invested mm-hmm. in delivering a credible service as well.
You've been in not only a business as an entrepreneur,
right,
as a founder, which is inherently volatile,
right,
but you've been in an industry that is inherently volatile. I want you to think back.
Yeah.
And I want you to think about, when I say this, what immediately comes to mind.
Okay.
The most challenging moment you experienced in your business.
Right.
And how you got through that.
Okay. Well, clearly the recession. The recession of 2007, 8, 9, and 10, 11. So I had a dream. I had a dream when that happened, that I was hiking with my client, and we were in a precipitous area of a a very dangerous canyon. And I came to a precipice. And then I woke up. But I came to a precipice. I mean, that's how scary it was. Uh-huh. I was dreaming about it. Uh-huh. That's how scary it was.
So, during it happening or before it happened?
No, during it. During it. So first of all, I had never experienced anything like what happened. And quite frankly, most of us hadn't in the industry. Certainly my clients, a few of them did who had been around for a little bit longer, like they'd been through the early 90s and all of that. And then the dot-com, you know, thing in the early 2000s. Yeah. But here we were 8-9 years later. So I had never been through anything like this. And so I'm a very loyal person. And I made many mistakes, myself and my partner. We held on to people too long.
Employees you're talking
about. Yes, absolutely. Because of the severity of the impact of, you know, not having much work. So that was number one. It was a scary time. The second thing was that I didn't take a check. In my firm, I have always run my firm where everybody else always gets paid first, regardless, doesn't make any difference. So I stopped taking a check. We also cut everybody's salaries that we could retain. We eventually had to, of course, let go of people. But for those people who we retained, we wanted everyone to let them know that, first of all, this is ubiquitous. We're doing this throughout the company. Mm-hmm. We all have to share this pain. Mm-hmm. And everybody totally understood that that was a completely viable approach to this issue. And then for my partner, I maintained as much of his salary as I possibly could through the first very severe portions of that period. And then as we began to get our footing and began to find work through our design build relationships, we began to stabilize. You know, obviously we cut our staff in half. Mm-hmm. You know, we cut some expenses, but in our industry as a service industry, there's not a lot we can cut.
Yeah.
I mean, salaries are the basic. And after that, I mean, you still have your rent, you still got all the other expenses. So we don't have a lot of expendables.
It's a very labor intensive industry. It's all up here. You get paid for the head and in the architectural side of things.
So here's what we did. I really firmly believe that you have to work really, really hard to have a successful business. And in order to do that, you got to deliver a great service. Mm-hmm. You have to. That's the essence of everything. You've got to deliver a great service. Well, we had a great reputation and we had a really fantastic collaborative partner in, at that time, JKD had evolved into LGE, and they were, of course, one of the biggest design build firms around. And like I mentioned before, we had a fantastic run. So we just welded ourselves to each other. We were their architect for those first 3 or 4 or 5 years. We did 95 or 98% of all their work. Mm-hmm. We negotiated with them on all the money that we lost due to clients that couldn't pay them. Mm-hmm. Because at that time, we were getting paid by LGE for our services, our collaborative services. That's inherent in many, many design build kinds of relationships. That was fine. We were happy with that. So we were extremely collaborative and we were incredibly first of all, reliable and also available. So my partner and I, for those 5 years, we just sat in our offices and we didn't have anybody drawing our preliminary drawings for our preliminary designs and our initial efforts. He and I did all that. It was an extremely efficient way to work. Frankly, very, very satisfying for me personally. I just absolutely loved it. It's one of the most gratifying parts of our business for me is to be able to sit in front of a computer and design a building. And I loved that. But on the other hand, we had to do that. Mm-hmm. And so the way we got through it was relying on an extremely capable, one of the most capable contractor design build offices in the Valley, with a leader in Dave Sellers Jr., who was, you know, more than capable. He has a very famous reputation, of course, for being a tremendous provider. He went out and found a bunch of cash deals. In 2008, 2009, and 2010, he was working on a lot of things that lenders weren't going to lend on in that particular arena because so many of them, you know, weren't in the arena anymore, but he found cash deals to work on. And
so he just went out and raised capital.
He did, and he found ways to work around some of the lending inhibitions in the arena for his clients and customers that still needed work and still needed facilities and still needed remodels and whatnot. And at that time, although he also shifted, from light industrial to entertainment, he made a wide variety of associations in other industries, including healthcare, you know, even including education. So he found ways of getting projects. And of course, we were his primary support. And so we slowly, after cutting back and finding ways to cope, then we slowly began to stabilize. And the other thing I do have to say is that this is a time when, you know, we couldn't always meet payroll. And so I just contributed to the company. And I contributed what to anybody would be an important amount of money over all those years to be able to maintain the precept that everybody else got paid first.
And if I recall correctly, one of the things you're most proud of throughout your career is that you kept five people working during that whole time period.
I'll flip it. I kept 12 people busy for 5.5 years.
Wow.
Myself and my partner. Okay. Paul, my partner, is totally, totally responsible for easily half of that.
For all 5 years.
Oh, 5.5 years. Absolutely. Yeah.
When lots of people were going out of business.
Yes, absolutely. We were bigger than quite a few of the other firms that had cratered. So this is just an anecdote, but one of the certainly most prolific and very high profile firms here in the Valley really had to cut back so severely that we were larger than them for quite a few years, even though they had a much higher profile here in the Valley. But we're just in there grinding. We were in there grinding.
That's what you gotta
do. We did it.
You gotta have grit and you gotta grind. Was there ever a point during that period when you thought this is it?
No.
Never.
Oh, never. That's never even occurred to me on anything that's ever happened.
And so that's an interesting perspective
because
I know a lot of people who go through those periods, not that they wanted to give up,
right?
But that financially, it was just not
I was just in a position where I, you know, I could help, and I found ways to help. And actually, I mean, it wasn't easy for me either. I had to find a way.
Yeah.
But I did.
Yeah.
And between Paul and I, we kept everything intact. And the other thing is we kept everybody, like, nobody changed places. You know, the whole staff was like dedicated to us.
You grow a loyalty and a dedication to a firm that they can visibly see.
That's right.
Cares more about them.
And cares equally as much about them as all the other aspects of our business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it had to be a stressful time period.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it was like I got to the edge of the cliff and I looked over and then I had to wake up. So that's so interesting. I never thought about that. So I had to wake up in order to figure out what I was going to do next. I never thought about that.
That's
why I woke up.
And yeah, because you weren't going to go over the
cliff. There was no way I was going to go over.
You weren't going there.
So funny.
The human mind, though,
is
not, I don't believe,
yeah,
created to deal with the emotional volatility that comes with being not only an entrepreneur, but being in an industry that's this volatile.
Right.
Unless if someone's Superman and the only person that's capable of that would be God. How did you mentally and emotionally get through this time period?
Well, I knew that we could work hard and I knew we had a successful business. So I knew we had that stability. And I knew that in that particular period of time, they were going to need us, LGE was going to need us, and we were going to need them. So that much was at least stable.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me again what your intent of the question was.
How can, and maybe this time period, and there's other time periods that you know about that perhaps were more volatile for you emotionally than this particular time period?
No.
I didn't think so. But how did you get through that psychologically?
Oh, okay. All right. Well, so after all these years, see this gray hair? You eventually grow some emotional maturity. and some emotional stability. So, so I would say, first of all, that I've learned through business never to make assumption, never to make assumptions about anybody in regards to their response or reaction about anything. There's always a reason why someone, and I have a point for this, there's always a reason why somebody complains, somebody is mad, somebody is upset, somebody doesn't agree, something that causes tension. There's always a reason for that. So I've learned over time not to react until I actually find out. Because more often than not, somebody gets mad at you, you get mad back, and then suddenly you find out a little bit later that actually you were wrong. Mm-hmm. You didn't need to be mad at them because there was actually a basis for which they were mad. Yeah. And if you would just look at the actual instances for why they were mad, there are things you can work with there. You can work with them, you can work with yourself. And I've learned over time that that's the most important aspect mm-hmm. of actually running a business, is not to make assumptions about people, but actually, you know, join them. Join them in their irritation, join them in their distress, join them in their stress, join them in participating in whatever it is that, you know, is causing this stressful episode. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. So I've just learned not to be stressed out. Now, I carry a lot of stress with me, but I dampen that by thinking about what it is on their side. So the second part of that is obviously empathy. So I've learned over the years that it's very, very important to have empathy with our customers and our clients. But it's also, of course, very, very important to have empathy with our staff. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a hallmark of our business and our particular office. This is a little bit of a roundabout answer to your question, but I'm getting there. There's two aspects of empathy. So first of all, I've learned over time that you can't always discern it, but I do believe that for the most part, people always give what they most want to receive. And so as a consequence, if you can discern that in your relationships with them, you can understand what it is they're trying to give. And if you're open to what it is they want to give and you're a receptor for that, then you've created a relationship which is one of trust.
Can you be more specific? Give an example.
Yeah. You know, like when someone gets mad, if someone is mad in the office about something that doesn't work for them, it's important to let them know that it isn't helping necessarily for them to get mad. What does help is talk about what's making them mad in the first place. But the other thing is not responding to their getting mad. It's important for you to say, oh, you know, you're right. Yeah, darn, I'm sorry. Yeah, I get that. You know, I contributed to, you know, your irritation or whatnot. I get that.
So how does that jive with the philosophy, what they give is what they want to receive, because what they're giving is anger and judgment.
No, what they're giving is what they're upset about, which is what they care about.
Okay. They're just manifesting it as anger.
They're telling you what they care about.
You need to dig deeper to understand why they feel that way.
Absolutely. It's because that's what they care about.
Yep. Okay. So that's what you mean by they give what they want to receive.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And what you should give back is what they care about in response to what they care about.
Okay. So that's one.
I believe in that.
Okay.
Second of all is that I found in my life over time that I had, you described me as being warm. I had an ability over time to draw people out, which made them feel comfortable, which I enjoy and I appreciate that. Talk about, you know, giving what you most want to receive.
Mm-hmm. So, case in point, very well done.
So as a consequence, I've had a knack for that over the years where because I don't necessarily, and I've gotten upset before and, you know.
We're all human, right?
Of course, absolutely. Yeah. But I've learned to dampen that over the years. But the most important thing is that I've learned to kind of ferret out, you know, what people are irritated about and just kind of work from that angle. But on the other hand, I've found that I can work from that angle by drawing people out. And so I just love people. I love being with people. I love being with my staff. And, you know, that kind of joy radiates in the office when I'm there, when I'm talking to them, even about some subjects were a little bit difficult, which we can talk about in a bit. But on the other hand, I think that the joy of being able to interact over these issues and have empathy with people and let people know that you're not necessarily upset about this, that you actually understand why they're upset. Mm-hmm. And you acknowledge that and go like, oh my, yeah, no, you're right. You know, and show a little bit of response and show a little bit of partnership in that issue, whatever it is. And no one's perfect at it, and I'm not either. Yeah, well, but I like to do this, yeah. And I think it's very, very important in regards to your essential question, which is how do I cope with stress? You know, you look for things that are stressing everybody else out, and then you try and find a way to cope with them over the issue that is stressing them out, if you can. And join them in that. So here's the other thing about that. That also has a corollary in business. The great thing about being in our business and the thing that I have loved the most in regards to being an architect and working on buildings for people and their companies, that's a very, very, very stressful endeavor. It's one of the most stressful things they will ever participate in the development of their companies. And I've always promoted, as best we can, the attitude and the approach that, hey, we're your partners in this. We're going to join you in your stressful endeavor. And we're going to take part of that stress. Most importantly, since we've got so much liability out there, we're going to share with you part of your risk.
And how do you do that?
Well, through design build, I mean, we used to pay for our mistakes for many, many years. And over the years, of course, we have none that we've paid for because design build is, it's a crucible for getting it right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
When you have to pay for your mistakes, I mean, I've had mistakes in the past that this is, you know, 20, 25 years ago. This is a long, long time ago. I've had mistakes we've paid for. But on the other hand, it develops a relationship of accountability that you are accountable. And as I say, you know, we've worked our way out of all of those issues over the years. I mean, by working out, I mean, we've continued to improve our service to the point where we don't have issues like that anymore. But on the other hand, that's another thing about my own personality, which I think has been a contribution towards the success of our firm, which is that I have promoted this idea not only with our staff that, hey, we're in this with you, but with our customers, our clients, hey, we're in this with you. You know, you're in a very stressful situation here with one of the most expensive things you'll ever participate in. And we're not only going to share some of that stress with you, but we're also going to share some of the risk.
So how do you, I heard you say, pay for our mistakes.
Yeah.
Which I think is an excellent way and a successful way, as you've proven to do business.
Right.
But the counter side of that,
right,
and I have seen this many times
yeah.
in corporations, and it is inherent within all businesses where that mindset is taken, which I think is the mindset you have to take.
Right.
How do you prevent that from inhibiting creativity?
Right.
Because those are two separate ends of the spectrum, or they can be if you don't actively work to bring those two together. I've seen it. You're going to pay for the mistake that you've made and people inherently become, okay, I'm not going to do anything outside of the box because if I get creative and it ends up costing money, then I'm going to have to pay for it.
Well, that's a good question. I want to take a step back is that we've worked our way out of that as an approach to our relationships these days. So we're always participating in every issue that comes up to a much, much deeper extent than we ever did before. What I want to say is that all through our design build a portion of our career for 20 years, the contractor was responsible for construction administration. So they were the ones who solved all those issues out there. And as a consequence, we didn't really have much of a contribution in regards to monitoring and managing construction in the field. We answered questions and whatnot, but it was pretty minimal. However, when we went out on our own away from our design build relationships and just started to have a much broader group of clients and work in many, many more arenas rather than just light industrial, we we actually started our own construction administration department in the firm. Okay. And it's a three-person firm that manages all of that. So we're deeply involved every day with questions about the actual construction of all of our projects, which is a great point of pride for us. We're actually one of the few offices, I think, in the Valley of our size, small to medium, that actually has a dedicated, what we call CA, Construction Administration Department. And we're very, very proud of that. So the thing that you have to do is you have to limit your liability by not only focusing on a quality product which goes out into the field that's really going to be airtight, but then also has a specification with it and a wide variety of other criteria for procedures for actually constructing that. And we have evolved tremendously over the past 10 years in regards to our delivery of those kinds of services. It doesn't necessarily, to get back to your question of how does it impact our creativity, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. So over the past 10 years, we've brought on a couple of new architects in the office that are tremendous designers. And where my partner and I over the years are good designers, these guys are great designers. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really going to and have already completely enhanced our design profile in the office. I'm so excited for them because they are going to set new heights for design accomplishment in the Valley. And quite frankly, we had a couple of award winners over the last few years. But in any case, it doesn't inhibit our creativity. For the most part, cost issues are just mistakes in regards to the actual translation of the creative idea into the technology it's going to take to build it. And so we're tremendous in our office by having created a feedback loop that is a huge focus for us in regards to how we deliver our services. So this is very technical what we do. Architecture is a very, very technical mm-hmm. business. It's very, very involved. It's actually quite difficult what we do.
Oh, I'm in construction yeah. and I look at some of these plans and sit there and as a matter of fact, I'll sit and study plans for hours. Yeah. And I'm like, who in the world wants to do this
right.
for their, these people have to be absolutely crazy.
We're not. We love what we're doing.
But that's
so satisfying.
You love what you do.
Of course,
and
absolutely.
That's, you have to be able to go through that.
Thank you. But it doesn't inhibit our creativity. And the other great thing about design build is that you're working within a budget. So mm-hmm. we already know what the budget is. So we already know the parameters and the constraints we're looking at. So it doesn't inhibit our creativity. As a matter of fact, of course, as we all would acknowledge, if the more constraint you have, the more you're pressed to come up with creative solutions for a particular aesthetic or a design vocabulary mm-hmm. that expresses something within the vocabulary that you have. Mm-hmm. And so, as a matter of fact, it doesn't inhibit or repress, creativity, on the part of the designers in the office. It actually enhances it. So it's, once again, that's a crucible too.
Yeah.
And we're all responding beautifully to the crucible that, we're facing in the office.
Well, and that comes through experience for sure.
Absolutely.
One of the things I think you guys have done an impeccable job of, really as a model for many other firms,
yeah.
large public companies, I dare to say, is culture. And you have this saying,
yeah,
all working is learning.
Right.
Talk to us about how someone can instill that concept. Number one, what does it mean to you?
Right.
And number two, how do you put that saying
right.
into practice? Because we've all heard fancy things about culture and our culture is great and we
right.
do this. I care about the reality
right.
and the practicality of the application of those principles in the day-to-day operations.
Okay. So it's based upon two very key precepts. The first is that in order to have a successful workplace environment, you got to have a successful practice. You've got to really be good at your work. You have to deliver a successful product or project. you know, or a service, I should say, a service or a product. So that's very, very important. And of course, we focus on that all the time. So that's very important. But that is key to understanding then how you create a successful workplace environment.
So you got to be profitable.
Yeah, you got to be profitable.
I mean, that's what creating or delivering a successful experience or service means. You have to be profitable. Otherwise, you can't do any of the things you want to do.
That's correct. But even more importantly, you have to deliver the service as it's intended to be delivered. And it has to work towards the outcome that the client or customer was expecting. That's really the ultimate. And so as a consequence, some of our projects aren't all that profitable. We can all in business point to, you know.
Well, sure. Of course.
Aspects.
Overall, you have to be profitable.
Correct.
That's what I'm
saying.
That's
correct. Exactly right. Very good point. But the precept is you got to have a successful business. Then that contributes to a successful workplace environment. So the next thing is then that what we've done is twofold. So the first is that you have to want your staff or your employees to be fully engaged in your work process. And we feel that the most important aspect about that is that anyone who comes to work with us should actually be working on their career first. They should be thinking that whatever they're doing for us in their role with us is contributing to their career, growing their career, that they are enjoying this aspect of their career, and that it's fulfilling at this particular time. That's number one. And number two is that there's an opportunity to grow, and there's an opportunity to continue to expand in whatever way they want. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. So
so a successful service or product, which is delivering in your industry and really any industry, what the client is expecting to be delivered.
Correct.
And of course, you need to do that profitably if you're going to continue as a firm.
Perfect.
And then number two, focusing on the people that actually make that come to fruition.
Right.
And their life path, career path.
Thank you. Perfect. Okay. And so we've spent a tremendous amount of time on that, and we have really done a great deal in that arena. So the first aspect of that is focusing on the individual, not the service, but just the individual. And we want them to be as deeply engaged in their own careers while they work for us as they possibly can be. So here's what we do. In that regard, the first thing is, of course, when someone comes on board for a particular role, we not only show them, of course, the job description we expect them to perform on, we show them the job description of the level above them so that they get an understanding.
That's great.
Of what it is that we feel that they should be capable of if they succeed at that their particular level. Mm-hmm. That's number one. And number two is that we promote that regularly. So we have yearly reviews, just like every other office, but we also do something else, which is that we have one-on-ones. So we're a studio-driven office. We have five studios. We have those studios are managed by our studio directors, who are either associates or principals in the firm. And about every 6 weeks or so, they'll get with their entire team one-on-one, 15, 20 minutes. And this is a conversation that is strictly driven by the staff member. There's no agenda. The studio director is there just to listen and to absorb. And so this is an opportunity for a staff member to complain about their neighbor, complain about their director, complain about their principal, complain about the hours, complain about, you know, this, that, or the other thing. But they don't do that very often. What they do complain about is, you haven't given me enough time on this project to finish it the way I really want to.
Yeah.
We hear a lot of that, and that's such good feedback. Mm-hmm. It's very important because it's contributing to our slow understanding of what it takes, you know, for them to do their job and what we can do to give them the resources they need, you know, in order to succeed at what they're doing. Because quite frankly, they work on 90% of the projects. We only look at the first 10% and the last 10%. And even then, we're not going to look at, you know, every little detail. of what they do. Mm-hmm. These are the coordinators in our office who draw projects mm-hmm. and who coordinate and pull the projects together. But after our one-on-ones, where we're managing and we are touching base with them on how they're feeling and issues that they have, then it's our responsibility as leadership, the studio directors, to actually respond and get back to them on, hey, we can do this, we can do that, we can do the next thing, so that people feel like they're being heard. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we do. The next thing that we do is that ultimately, when you grow through the ranks of being a person who, you know, is a coordinator in our office, and that's an AIA designation for someone who draws and pulls buildings together and works with the consultants, the other engineers, and the other collaborators on our projects, and works with the clients and works with the cities and works with the contractors, they can eventually grow to be architects. So in our arena, of course, we're licensed, just like doctors mm-hmm. and so many other professionals. You can become a licensed architect either by getting a degree and then working for a few years in the field, or you can work in the field for many, many years and still become eligible to become a registered architect. Mm, okay. And as a consequence, we have promoted that heavily in our firm. We are a subscriber to a service that provides all of the written materials to take all these registration tests. And they're the ones who provide the practice tests and do all that. And we started out with 6 or 8 people in our firm who are very interested in that. And it's dwindled to 2 or 3. But on the other hand, they're still out there and we're still pushing them. So mm-hmm. there's always a way to evolve and to grow in our company. The next thing is we have an associates program. So not only can you grow as a professional in regards to the delivery of a particular service and a particular role, you can grow in regards to your contribution towards our firm as a leader and as our mentor. And we have 3 associates in our office right now who all were, you know, started as those coordinators and have grown into, frankly, studio director roles, 2 of the 3, but also equally as importantly, mm-hmm. into a role that's acknowledged as a leader and as a mentor in the firm. And then finally, we haven't mentioned this yet in our discussion today, in our conversation, but our firm is actually going through a transition right now. So my partner and I are on a retirement path. We are ultimately going to be retired. We're going through a transition right now. Mm-hmm. And 4 of our leadership team are going to become the leaders of the firm. Well, they were the previous architects who were doing all of the designing and all of the mentoring and all of this and all of that. Well, now they have new roles, which has created a whole nother level of opportunity mm-hmm. for people in the office, you know, to rise up into. So you have to really give people the opportunities to grow. And that's one of the principles of all of, you know, all of working is learning, is that with the obvious evidence of the learning is for you to grow and get better and better and also raise to a higher level and obviously get paid more. So that's something that we focus on. One of our studio directors is our interior designer. So just very briefly, the best example, she's our best example. Very briefly, she came into the office right out of college and started drawing for us and became within, you know, 5 or 8 years, our very highest level coordinator, our best coordinator and drawer. So she eventually came to us and says, hey, I'd love to get back into interior design, you know, which is where I started and what I have my degree in. And so she now is an interior designer for us. So she graduated through all levels in our firm, not only professionally, but then also leadership wise as well.
And then you guys, that got the firm into interior design.
And it was perfect for us. And everyone loves working with her and she's fabulous. And so that's been a very, very successful part of our story.
I appreciate you sharing those principles, because I don't think it matters what industry you're in, what size of business you're in. Those principles you just described, and the application of how you actually manifest that in the day-to-day operations,
right,
anybody can put in place. And that's how you build a long-term successful company, by having those foundations there.
Thank you.
I want to take it, we've talked a lot about the construction industry,
right, yeah,
and
yeah,
kind of the industry in which you're in. And I want to broaden our scope a little bit,
okay,
and just talk about entrepreneurship and business in general.
Yeah.
Based on your years of experience,
yeah,
when someone is looking to go out on their own, start their own company,
right,
there is a degree of risk involved.
Yep.
And a large degree of risk.
Right.
And it varies industry to industry. It obviously varies based on what they're trying to accomplish. But I think one of the things that people always wonder, and why I enjoy having conversations with someone who has gone through 45 years of experience in a volatile industry and in the volatility of being a business owner,
right,
is you can tell us what works and what doesn't work and what has led to your success. So I want to ask you this. Why do you think some people succeed and others don't?
I can tell you that my own story is that I'm just a person who always have felt like if I just sit here and water the grass a little bit longer, eventually it's going to get a little greener.
So,
but the other thing is I always recognize the challenge of getting better. I mean, I could see what needed to be done in order to get better. And so that was very exciting to me. It didn't make any difference whether it was on the, you know, on the leadership side or on the technical side or on the design side, the relationship side. I always could recognize, you know, how I could improve. So, and the other thing is once you get that opportunity, you've got to seize it. You have to seize the opportunity and you have to perform. You have to. It doesn't make any difference what it takes. You have to perform. But if you can get a foothold in your initial effort and find a client, a customer, a patient, whoever, who is going to understand that you've delivered, you know, something that, first of all, they may not even have expected, but most importantly, gives them confidence that they've received the service or, you know, the product that they really needed or wanted, then you can build off that. And that's exactly what it takes. You've got to have the opportunity and then you've got to perform.
I want to take us back to the days that you were talking about earlier when you were in Boston.
Yeah.
And I want to dig a little deeper.
Okay. Those. All right.
What, and I see this all the time, and this question stems from, I believe we as a society, because of social media and because of many things in society, right, are becoming less emotionally stable and less introspective of what we need to do to be successful. And what I heard you say earlier in the podcast is emotional intelligence.
Right, correct.
In challenging situations, how you control yourself and then listening to the other individual and listening to the other individual.
Right.
Not just hearing, but actually listening.
Right.
What did you learn about yourself or what did you discover during those 7 years that allowed you to break out of that state of depression or sadness of thinking that you weren't going to be an architect? And I'm not asking you to get so personal. What I'm asking you is, things you can share that other people who maybe are in that period, and everybody goes through that period at different points in life.
Right.
It can be after, usually it's after a significant life event.
Right.
But tell us what you learned about yourself and what people can take away from that if they're going through a struggling time like that.
Well, I think it's important to get help. I think if you're depressed, I think it's important to get help and to, you know, to be willing to get help. So you're correct. There's a stigma to therapy and a stigma to being in therapy, which is too bad.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Well, I don't. One of the things would be, you know, people want to feel like they're independent and can handle themselves, and so as a consequence, you know, I've heard it expressed many times. Well, I don't need that. I'm not going to get anything there. That would be one of the reasons. Some people may be afraid that they're going to learn something about themselves that they would be afraid to know about, which is really too bad. But on the other hand, that could be another reason. I think there's, you know, approval. You know, your parents or someone that you love or a social setting that you're in may disagree or may disapprove in some way or other. So it's important to find a little bit of support somewhere along the way. Mm-hmm. But also to just dip your toe into it and find a way. There's so many resources out there these days for all kinds of help. So I think it's important, first of all, to take the first step.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to find a way to take the first step. you know, there may be people in your life who are encouraging you to get a little bit of help, and maybe you're resisting them. Maybe those are the people you're mad at, or, you know, don't have a relationship with, and so don't want to listen to. But on the other hand, you have to consult yourself, and you have to be willing to just be a little bit open to those first few conversations. And the next level is finding someone who can actually help you. So actually, that's very difficult. I lucked into a situation that really helped me a lot. You know, I went through a couple therapists before I found one, but on the other hand, I found a fantastic one.
How did you know when it was the right one?
Oh, it was just conversation.
Okay.
Just conversation.
It's like
it just
that.
Clicked. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, that can be vexing for people. Oh, I went to this therapist and, you know, he didn't do anything for me, or, yeah, I know that, or whatever. I mean, it might be a wide variety of things.
Yeah.
So between some support from your closely held and from a little bit of internal inquisitiveness about, well, that didn't necessarily work, but I still think this might work. But, you can't give up.
Yeah,
I think that's another thing about, you know, being depressed. You really shouldn't give up. So here's the thing about depression. Ready for this?
Mm-hmm. All yours.
You have to take action. That's the key. That is the ultimate key in being depressed. You have to take action.
And what do you mean by that?
You have to do something. You have to do something to address your depression. And claiming that you're not depressed is, you know, the most popular way of handling
that's
it.
That's the worst that, way of handling it.
Of course it is. Absolutely. That's what everybody does. That's the first. You have to take action. And so what you've described is, you know, hey, you know, audience, you know, listen to Sherm. You know, he's had this experience. This could be valuable for you. Well, yeah, it turns out to be, in my own personal experience, turned out to be extremely valuable, and one that I have coveted, you know, my whole life, because it helped me in ways that I couldn't get help before. Here's the thing. You ready for this? When I was growing up in Tucson, those were the 50s and the 60s, and my parents couldn't talk to me about feelings. It wasn't part of our society at that time.
100% true.
It wasn't part of our society. There was no context for that. My dad went out and actually worked in a job that he wasn't all that happy with. But that's the way he showed his love, by providing for the family every day and coming home and knowing that he had provided for us. You know, and my mom, the same way. I mean, she could talk to me a little bit better. But on the other hand, there was no talk about feelings in the home.
And that's very common during that time period, because they showed their feelings through action.
Yes.
They didn't feel the need to verbalize it.
Exactly. And so, you know, I needed help by the time I got to my 20s. You know, and that's
I've heard that so many times.
And it's not a criticism.
No.
It's just a reflection on who we were and how we all have evolved. But you do. You can't give up, and you do have to take action.
Yeah. So. And I think that is what you said. Number one, I think a lot of people, and you hit it on the head, we lie to ourselves more than anybody. And people that don't want to have an outside party come into and break apart all our lies, that's probably the number one reason people are like, oh, I'm fine, or I don't need help, or I don't need to talk about my feelings, because they're afraid to, really.
Yeah.
Because
that's right.
You're
afraid to.
Yeah. It'll be what it reveals.
Yeah.
But how can you fix anything?
Well,
if you're not even willing to confront.
Right.
Truth.
Well, and that, you know, one of your previous, invitees, Jonathan Keyser, talked about that. He talked about the society of, what was it, fear and something else.
Why do you think society is that way? Do you think it's getting better? And why do you think society is that way?
Oh, absolutely. It's getting way better. But on the other hand, you look at the politics today and you wonder.
Well, I think so much of our society,
it's
a facade. So much of society, Sherm, is a facade, and I cannot figure out why so many people want to pretend to be who they aren't, or portray a certain image to please someone else. Number one, that's incredibly exhausting. And number two, what an awful way to live.
Well, you have to have had some great experiences in regards to your authentic self,
yeah.
You know, in order to be reassured that actually that's appropriate. And so I'm not going to pontificate because I don't know anything about it.
Well, you do, but okay. So,
but you know, in regards to, you know, my history and my thinking about it, I mean, you have to realize your roots are where you came from, and we all came from a much, much different society.
Yeah.
Our society is so much more prolific, so much deeper, so much more expansive. There is such a greater cornucopia of resources and understandings. Even over the past 20 or 30 years, we're so much richer for it. We're all much, much richer for it. So, and that's to everybody's, you know, great credit, including guys like yourself who are out there, you know, wanting people to contribute and inviting people to contribute and inviting people to share and grow closer together in regards to, you know, all of our mutual efforts, which we all care about, all respect in others.
Yeah, it's a very foundation of why I started the podcast, because you're two or three of my original business in the waste services industry. Yeah. I remember we were fluttering bankruptcy, didn't know how I was going to pay for payroll the next day.
Yeah.
And there was all this weight and fear of what claiming bankruptcy meant.
Right.
And, you know, there's a million people around you, but you're all alone.
Correct.
And I vowed when I had the opportunity to start something that could act as a support system for people to share,
ta-da,
I would do it. And this is the manifestation of that.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank
this
you.
This is a great opportunity.
Yeah.
It's
and
fantastic.
I think we in society don't value enough, and I think we're getting better, the wisdom and experience that individuals like you who have done so many things and been through so many different economies, so many different periods of technological advancement,
right,
so many everything can provide. And so that leads me to my next question.
Okay.
You're in your early 70s, correct?
Correct.
What, after all these years, do you wish you could go back and tell 33-year-old Sherm that you wish you had known at that point? So this would have been when you're back in Phoenix now, that you could only have learned through all the life experiences that you've had.
Well, that everything's going to be okay.
Okay.
You know, I probably knew it, but I wasn't too worried about it then. I don't know. That's such a great question. I'd actually have to think about that. I don't know. I mean, I think I've over time accumulated the kinds of things and the kind of little nuggets and the kinds of insights that I've been describing with you. And thank you for drawing them out. I appreciate that. So I don't know that there really would have been anything. I certainly know that there wouldn't have been anything that I would have changed. I think here's one thing. So here's actually a really cool thing.
I knew it would come to you.
Okay.
People say, I've heard that response many times. We're like, I don't think. And they're like, oh, there's something.
Yeah, there is something here. So here is a wonderful reflection. So I have a family. I have two boys. And they're out on their own careers and they're married. And
how old are they now?
They're in their mid to late 30s.
Okay. So you have grandkids?
No,
not yet. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's still an amazing part in your life.
Oh, yeah.
That my parents would tell me that you have to look forward to.
So thank you very much. But they haven't selected a very, very important part of their lives that was inherent in mine. So inherent in my life is a tremendous work ethic where I have sacrificed a great deal and always worked a great deal. In regards to that, I haven't had, from somebody else's point of view, an ideal work-life balance, which of course is such a huge conversation, of course, in our society mm-hmm. these days, and appropriately. Mm-hmm. I just plunge myself in. Now, I happen to have one individual aspect of my life which really helped me there, which is not available to everybody, and which I was able to convert to a successful way of working and living. But I was actually a single dad for 16 years. So my former wife and I had a co-parenting arrangement where I had the boys for a week and she had the boys for a week. So I actually had a week to myself. Mm-hmm. And I had relationships in then during that time too. But for the most part, I was able to devote myself to what I really cared about, which was architecture and doing a great job. Mm-hmm. So that's so I have worked a tremendous amount in my life. So if I had anything, this actually, I probably should have turned around. I could have turned around because I've made sacrifices in my life, which others enjoy and I have fewer of. And that's like a community of friends that you spend a lot of time with. Like, I'm fun to hang out with, but I don't hang out with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And other people in their work-life benefits when they have a work-life benefits when they have a family and they're an
work-life intact balance. Is what,
thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
But benefits. This was a Freudian slip, but an appropriate one. you know, there's benefits to the way other people live their lives. Like my partner and his family and many, many of my associates and all have a very healthy kind of work-life balance where they're enjoying their friends on weekends and they're going out and doing things. And, you know, myself and my wife, she's been so patient, so understanding with me. We have a great life together, a wonderful life, but I still work a lot. And so I think that would be the thing. Now, my sons, my one boy has made a complete life decision that doesn't interest him at all and has a wonderful solution to that, which I'm so proud of. My other boy is getting into a very heavy professional relationship, which requires a great deal for him that's beginning to stress him out. Because why? Because he saw what I did over my life. And he always, both boys never complained. They never dissed me for this. And they always respected me for what I did. But on the other hand, they're going like this.
Yeah. No, thank you. Hard pass.
Hard pass. Thank you very much. So thank you for asking that question, because I reflect on that regularly. And I think, you know, if there was something I could change, I really should have changed that. I should have had a broader, you know, kind of a group of friends, you know, people we spend time with and spend effort on that too.
Don't you think you would have been less successful professionally speaking had you done that?
Well, yeah, that's true.
Because work-life balance is important.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's obviously a huge topic.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite quotes of all times, particularly relevant to this conversation, secularly speaking, is from Jack Welch, no longer around, the former CEO of General Electric.
Yep, GE.
And he said, there's no such thing as a work-life balance.
Well, good for him.
There are work-life choices.
Yes. Okay. That's great.
And that's very, very true.
Right.
So one of your sons has made the choice.
Right.
You know what? I don't need to have that level of success professionally or financially speaking.
Right.
Because it's going to be at the expense of an incredibly full, enjoyable personal life.
You know what?
That's a choice.
He's such a hero for me. I mean, I just look at that and I go like, oh my. You know, the other thing is, it's scary for me. I don't know if I could have done that.
You couldn't. So that, and this is coming from someone, Carrie, I know you're listening. So work-life choices are incredibly important conversations to have with the people important in your life.
Yes.
Because the reality is, Sherm,
you
couldn't have been any different than who you were.
Right.
I know that.
Well, I'm very happy.
Genetically, you could not have been any different because I'm the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love working.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love the hunt.
Yeah.
And that's why I believe if you're an entrepreneur, you're either born with it or you aren't.
Well, it could be.
You know, and I've talked to tons of entrepreneurs.
Right.
And that's what I've concluded.
Yeah.
And if you're born with it.
Yeah. Well.
It's a crucible you will have to deal with.
Oh, well, that's it. And, you know, and I'm not unhappy with my choices, but I look back and I go like, well, I could have really done better.
Yeah. And I appreciate you sharing that reflection I think it is so important. What I think is the piece that a lot of people miss is having those conversations early up front.
Right.
So that expectations,
right.
You know, whether if your parents, your grandparents, your spouse, your
families,
children,
yeah,
your families, your friends, the people important. I remember in my 20s when you're supposed to have all these friends. Well, I was growing a business and that was 120 hours of my life.
Right.
So people just stop contacting you because like, well, I know he's never going to be able to do anything.
Right.
And then you get to your 30s and you're like, where did all my friends go?
Exactly.
But that was a choice that I made. And I'm not sad about that, but that is a choice that you made.
Right.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it's pertinent to everybody who's thinking about starting a company or being an entrepreneur.
Right.
And even those people who are in it. Have you had those conversations?
Right.
Because that's where you can set expectations and prevent problems later on.
Yeah.
When they may potentially arise.
Yeah. Well, you know, I try and buffer it as much as I possibly can, of course.
Yeah.
And I've done fine with that, but.
And it's different for everybody. Yeah. You know, what works for one family doesn't work for another family, and what works for one entrepreneur, but it's figuring out what works for you. I think that's what's important.
Well, thanks for asking the question.
Well, yeah, I appreciate you sharing that honest, authentic response, because I think a lot of people mm-hmm. are afraid to reflect on things as personal as, you know what, I would have maybe done this differently.
Right.
But I think most people who have been as successful as you are, I listen to tons of episodes of a podcast called Founders Podcast, and all they do is study entrepreneurs through biographies or autobiographies. And that's probably one of the number one things they all say is, I wish I would have had a little bit more work-life balance.
Yeah. Well, here's the other way to you know, the famous joke. And I think that, I think I heard it on Dave Letterman one time, which is that there's one thing that St. Peter has never, ever heard when anyone ever has approached the pearly gates. And that is, geez, if I could only have spent a few more hours in the office.
Yeah, no, I've heard that one. And that's true. But I would say the alternative is the way you provide for your families and you create the economic engine of growth.
Of course.
We have all the things we have in our society is because there's people like you.
Well, thank you. And the other thing is, this is a joyful enterprise on my behalf. For me, it's joyful for me. And so I think it's also very important to impart that joy, be part of the joyful aspects of what we do together, and promote that and draw that out, because, you know, it's certainly been gratifying for me, and I want it to be gratifying for everyone that I'm associated with.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to work that much in our lives, hopefully there's some enjoyment
of
there,
course.
Right? And for like 98% of America, a lot of them dread going to their jobs every day.
No, it's not that high.
I just made that number up, but it seems like a lot. You've been very gracious with your time, Sherm. So I want to conclude on this, and it's pertinent to current events.
Okay.
The economy.
Yeah.
Tell me what you see after all the years you've been in the construction industry.
Right.
You've seen the ups, you've seen the downs, you've seen the all arounds. We're in a very interesting time.
Yep.
The Fed has kept rates where they are.
Right.
They're at about 5.25 to 5.5.
Right.
They raised them very quickly.
Yep.
From March 2022 up until through 2023, they're holding them steady, data dependent. I have my own personal beliefs about what I think is coming and where the economy is going to go.
Right.
Tell us your perspective.
Well, I think there is a wild card out there in regards to what the administration is going to be in the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have any insight into that.
Take me down that path, because that's an interesting question that a lot of business owners, setting politics aside, they like stability. If Biden gets reelected, where do you see things playing out? If Trump gets elected, where do you see things playing out, economically speaking?
I don't have any insights into that.
Okay.
Other than it would be obvious that the economy is very, very strong. And as a consequence, and certainly the local economy is very, very strong. So I certainly see that as continuing. I can't imagine that an administration would have such a deep impact in regards to the local economy, even if the administration does change. And here's why. It's because so much of what's in motion right now has more to do with the technological aspects of our economy. We're seeing a tremendous influx of technology and technology-related companies these days into the Valley in every avenue, whether it be food processing, data centers, you know, manufacturing, of course, TSCM and everything that's coming on, you know, in regards to chip manufacturing and whatnot. And of course, the administration has played a vital role in supporting that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty, that's going to be immune to necessarily policy changes. The only thing that could really hurt the economy is some kind of recession. And that's, of course, an open question that we seem to have danced around. And
that is the question. Yeah. Is a recession coming?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know, but I can tell you that short term, I don't even know. It certainly seems like it isn't. And also, I do want to point out that the real estate industry, of course, has weathered the pitfalls of the increased interest rates in regards to the impact on especially speculative projects, but the industry has weathered that,
and thus far
exactly right. And we don't see that as changing. For instance, inflation's not going up, it's stable. They want it to come down, but on the other hand, it's not going up. And there's no.
It's starting to tick up the last few readings by 0.2%, 0.3%, which is why the Fed,
right.
It was previously thought they were going to cut rates at their June meeting, maybe 3 times, and they paused that.
Right.
Now there's less likelihood that they're going to do that at the June meeting. But don't you believe that in the long term, just financially, mathematically, you look at the discounted cash flow model to value anything.
Right.
When you raise rates as much as we did,
inherently
values have to come down in the long run.
Well, that's fine. But on the other hand, there's still a tremendous, in our locale, there's a tremendous influx of capital. Billions, hundreds of billions of dollars are coming into the valley and are being programmed for growth and expansion here. Because of a number of aspects. First of all, no natural disasters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, huge. Cheap electric rates,
mm-hmm.
a great workforce, and great workforce economy that's going to continue to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what GPEC says about the Valley, which is all I know about. And that
GPEC, what is that?
The Greater Phoenix Economic Council.
Oh, okay.
And they are the leading driver and facilitator for economic growth here in the Valley.
Okay.
They're the ones who have reached out to all these companies in California to relocate from California.
Okay.
And they're the ones who field all of the initial questions coming in from every company around the nation that is eyeing Phoenix as a landing spot for either new endeavors or for, growth opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what they say. So we're going to continue to grow at 100,000 people a year for the next 10 years, for the next 5 decades. So that's it's 1 million people a year for the next 4 decades now that we're in our 20s, could be even 5 decades. That's 50 years. So that's going to be 5 million people. That's going to double the size of Arizona over the next 50 years. And there's so many reasons for that, including the broader economic base now that the Valley offers and all this tremendous rush of new industry here into the Valley to support, what the Valley has started in terms of bioenergetics and biomedicine and,
mm-hmm.
These other technologically oriented firms and companies. And then also look what the universities have done and education and everything. So we've really diversified, but the growth is going to be here. And look at the tremendous influx and the new development of multifamily, for instance, and the growth that's going on, and we have room to grow. So, and the water, by the way, is not necessarily a limiting factor. We have to manage it, but we're better at managing the water than other states. And parenthetically, as the state has continued to say, there's always enough water for people, just not quite enough for agriculture. And so there's going to be a slow turning over of agriculture to people in the industry slowly over the time.
I never figured that out. Let's go to one of the hottest places in the country that already
right.
has water problems,
right.
and let's have agriculture be one of our main industries.
And,
what?
But it was one of the main...
And by the way, let's have international countries be the ones that are leading the agricultural for. I mean... Common sense here, people.
Right.
Okay.
It's slowly turning.
It is turning.
Yes.
As a necessity, just for the growth that we're getting from different industries.
Right.
What, weren't people saying the same thing in 2007 and 2006?
Perhaps so, but they didn't see the bust coming and the recession. So I'm not an economic.
But you've had a lot of experience, and that's why
I
turn to people like you who have seen these before.
Okay. I would say there's two things that I am worried about.
Okay.
These are one of which is absolutely going to happen. We just don't know how.
Okay.
The other could happen, and we also don't know. But the first is that we continue. We're our growth rate in regards to assuming debt nationally is growing asymptotically. So it's not growing on a straight line. It's growing at an asymptotic curve, which means that it's growing increasingly quicker the more we borrow. So recently we passed the threshold where now we pay more, for instance, for paying off our debt, for instance, than we spend on the military and whatnot.
Our debt service requirements, just the interest costs.
So that is absolutely going to come. It's coming. I don't know. You know, I'm worried for my firm because they've got a 10, 15 year runway mm-hmm. with the next leadership group. And so, you know, there is going to be a time that the entire country is going to be facing some kind of a crisis in that regard. And I don't know how that's going to work and how it's going to be managed, but that's coming.
We're going to have austerity measures.
And the other thing is then that, you know, there's so much pressure on, you know, Social Security and Medicare and all the entitlements. So I'm not an expert. I don't know. But on the other hand, I can tell you, like everybody else knows, it's unsustainable. That's all I know. Yeah. It's unsustainable.
So if you were president,
right,
what do you think are the actions we should take?
Well,
again, this isn't a political question. This is simply an economic question.
Well, just getting a bipartisan agreement, you know, and the Republican Party has continued to try and get something done on this area many, many times is, you know, limit spending to 1% or take 4% out of the federal budget and all the departments and stuff like that. So it's got to be some kind of bipartisan.
But at the same,
But it has to be a recognition and a realization and an acceptance
on both sides.
On both
because
sides,
everybody take partisan politics out of it. Right. The last 4, 5, 6, 7 administrations have spent. We haven't had a balanced budget since President Clinton and Newt Gingrich with the Contract with America came together and actually balanced our budget. Think about that. That's 30 years ago.
That's right.
And since then, our spending, as you said, has just gone exponentially up, up, up.
Right.
And not one single administration, and we've had lots of Republican administrations, we have lots of Democratic administrations during that time period, have done anything to solve it.
Well, no, there was one. You know, Obama had that agreement with the Republicans. And there's a word, and I can't remember the word, but it starts with the letter R. And it's where they had pre-programmed cuts in spending if they couldn't meet certain budgetary criteria.
It didn't work.
It did work. It did work, but it wasn't enough.
It did work, but it wasn't enough.
And they kept it until...
I love politics, so I can't believe I can't think of the word, but...
It's something like restitution or something, but that's not the right
word. So we had attempts. We just either didn't go far enough for long enough.
We didn't keep them going.
Yeah.
We didn't keep them going.
Okay. So that was number one.
Right.
Number two.
An upcoming confrontation with China. So China has enormous ambitions.
Yes, they do.
I'm not a politician, and I've had the fortunate experiences of having several presentations on this from through a volunteer group that I work with over at Luke Air Force Base. And they're completely dialed in to an upcoming, not a conflict necessarily, but it's certainly a confrontation.
Does it have to do with Taiwan?
Yeah, it does. And of course. But more importantly, they're growing in strength, growing in economic strength. In a few years, they will have a larger economy than ours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they have a different approach to their world outlook than we do. They're not a democracy. And so as a consequence, but they're still extremely competitive with us. Ultimately, there's going to be some kind of confrontation over the South China Sea. And everything that goes through the South China Sea. So here's my only point. There's going to be a confrontation in the next few years when China feels that they are strong enough to challenge us. And we are mounting a huge effort to meet that challenge now.
Are we really?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
That is maybe something I'm not privy to.
Yeah.
That I, yes. You know, anybody who has followed politics or international geopolitics,
right.
This is obvious.
Yeah.
China has been doing this for the longest time.
Yeah.
They've been taking over smaller nations, giving them money, then indebting them, then taking over their harbors. Like, they're so good at this long game.
Yes.
And they have the benefit of doing it because they're a dictatorship.
Right.
And I don't remember what founding father, whether it was George Washington or Thomas Jefferson,
right.
said, here's your republic if you can keep it.
Right.
Republics and democracies are a lot harder to stay intact, and the average age is usually only 250 to 300 years. They're a dictatorship. They've been going on forever, and they have the benefit of doing that, and they know how to play these games because
They're learning. And once again, I'm no geopolitician. I don't know this for a fact.
And I'm not an expert by any means.
You're asking me what I'm concerned about.
I'm only concerned
about two worldwide events, and one, of course, would be it's worldwide debt, but it's certainly our debt. And then the second, of course, is an ultimate confrontation somehow that's going to revolve around the South China Sea. This is the only reason I bring it up, because a third to a half of the entire world's commerce all goes through the South China Sea. So even though,
you said a third
to a half of the world's commerce.
Goes
through the South China Sea.
Think about that. Think about what Sherm just said. A third to one half of all world commerce goes through the South China Sea, where most people would agree there is going to be some level of conflict in the next whatever time frame.
Not necessarily conflict, but confrontation of some kind.
Yeah.
It's going to be constricted in some way or another, and it's coming, but we just don't know in one shape or form. We really don't know.
Do you believe the United States will rise to the occasion?
Of course, absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it wouldn't make any difference what administration is.
Well, no, they're going to be, regardless of the administration, they will be forced to address whatever conflict comes in, no matter who it is.
Correct. And so my only concern, the impact on us, is that so many of the goods that we rely upon and so much of what we rely upon for our daily lives and commerce and whatnot would somehow ultimately be constricted. So look what the U.S. is doing. We're trying to reshore many, many of these critical industries that we all depend upon. And there's a huge push to reshore as much as we possibly can. Well, all that's in the right direction. And so
I think it's a great point. And I think those two looming conflicts or crises ones that we can still deal with now.
Yes, we could.
But if we wait too long,
they just get worse.
Like any problem. Ignore any problem, it doesn't go away. It just gets worse and worse.
Right, exactly.
Sherm, this has been incredibly enjoyable for me.
Well, thank you.
Hopefully the same can be said for you.
Absolutely. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
We've covered so many topics. Is there any final topic or words of advice or anything you want to share with me and the listeners that we haven't already talked about?
Just one thing, which is that our firm, which I've had the pleasure of being involved in over all these years, is going through a transition. And not only is this our 30th year that we're celebrating, my partner, Paul, and I are ultimately going to be taking even a bigger backseat. And, the new leadership in the firm we're very, very excited about. They all come from other firms and have other experience that they're contributing towards our health and our growth as a company. And I'm very, very excited for them and their future. And what we've decided to do as a group is to form a different, our firm is going to actually have a different structure going forward. And we are going to be an employee-owned company. So I'm so thrilled to be able to tell people as we go through this process of transition that we'll be an employee-owned company, and that all the staff members of the company will ultimately be entitled to stock, which they will have earned and they will deserve, and that we'll be able to form a retirement plan, an important retirement plan, in conjunction with and adjacent to their current 401ks that they currently have. And I'm really, really thrilled about that. It's a wonderful evolution of our firm that the new partners have all contributed mightily to. They're the prime movers of all of this effort that we've all contributed to over the last 10 years. But so excited to say that we are going through a transition and that we're going to be an employee-owned company.
Yeah, and I think what I'm glad you brought up ESOP, Employee Stock Owned Plan, is essentially correct. What you're going through.
Right.
And so for our listeners and viewers, basically, Sherm and Paul own the company, and they are now transitioning to an ESOP.
Right.
And you're working with the principal group to do so, correct?
Right. That's correct.
And not it's an incredibly powerful, motivating, and incentivizing way to transfer the ownership of an entity,
right,
as you've described,
right,
so that those who carry on the legacy of the firm have a greater degree and incentive to do so.
Correct.
And I think I'm seeing more and more of that happen, quite
yes,
frankly,
yeah,
because people realize all the tax benefits,
yes,
all of, and there are a lot of great tax benefits. We're not going to talk about them, nor neither one of us are experts on those.
Right.
And just from a logical way, when you can get people incentivized,
right,
where as they contribute, they benefit,
right,
and grow with the firm,
right,
what better way to transfer ownership than something like that?
It's a perfect vehicle for us to carry on what we started this conversation with, which is buy-in, you know, getting the staff members to buy into what it is you're accomplishing together, but also finding ways and reasons to stay and stay involved. Remember, we started the conversation with, you know, we want people to be here working with us at a time when they feel like they're doing the most for their career.
Yeah.
And what better way to not only have the satisfaction of seeing these projects, you know, get built, and participating in that, but then also getting the additional benefit of some of the profitability into a retirement account for themselves. So
I appreciate you bringing that up. And it's something, if you're someone who owns a company and you're not sure how to move forward, that might be an option for you. Of course, you've got to consult the appropriate professionals.
Right.
Sherm, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. We appreciate you coming in.
Well, thank you very much. I certainly appreciated the opportunity. It's been a pleasure for me too.
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to the Andrew Holland Podcast. Never miss an episode by subscribing to and liking our YouTube channel, The Andrew Holland Podcast, and by following and liking the show on your favorite audio platforms. Be sure to connect with us on X, formerly Twitter, A Holland Podcast. That's A Holland Podcast, so you can interact with Andrew, the team, and our guests throughout the week. Thank you again so much for listening. Have a great day, and we'll talk again soon.